or not directly affiliated with Hezbollah as a threat, and they're bombing it. Of course, this is only a way to demolish buildings in Lebanon and to further terrorize the Lebanese civilians.
And if you can talk about who uses this bank, do you agree that it's used to it's used for banking by Hezbollah, but also who else? And where are these banking branches located around Lebanon?
Yeah, I mean, these branches are located almost everywhere in Lebanon. In Beirut, mostly. These are banks that offer microcredits for the Lebanese. Of course, the majority of the constituency of Hezbollah benefit from these credits. Some people claim, and this is true, that there is no oversight over these financial institutions by the central Lebanese bank. But this is also an opportunity to remind everyone that private and commercial banks have escaped this accountability for years, and we have a collapsed banking sector now in Lebanon. So this is not these.
Well, let me ask you another question, and it has to do right now with UNIFIL and what's happening with the UN forces in southern Lebanon, and also how that relates to the UN Resolution 1701. But they say another watchtower has been blown up by Israel. Israel wants them out. The significance of this, Professor Mawad.
Yeah, it's very shocking, actually, that Israel wants the Blue Helmets, the UNIFIL group, to withdraw from Lebanon because they want to basically invade Lebanon. And UNIFIL has been very defiant so far, and they said, we're not withdrawing from the south. They even went far and said that there is no way that only one member of the United Nations would dictate on us what to do. UNIFIL is in the south based on a UN resolution, and this shows how aggressive and immune it shows how Netanyahu benefits from impunity. We saw him directly attacking the UNIFIL. We saw him as well directly attacking the UN Secretary General Guterres and declaring him as a persona non grata in Israel. We saw him also attacking and directly shaming President Macron when President Macron mentioned the possibility of imposing an armed embargo on the Israelis in order not to go on with their genocide in Gaza. The day after, he shamed him and told him, shame on you for even thinking about this. So this shows how aggressive and lunatic Netanyahu is, and is willing to do everything in order for him to move on and implement his expansionist project.
Jamil, you have the U.S. envoy, Amos Hochstein, now in Beirut. You have Blinken headed to Israel. It's not clear where he'll be on his tour. It is his 11th trip in the last year to the area. And you have the Israeli foreign minister, Israel Katz, warning, we will keep striking the Iranian proxy until it collapses. Also, if you can talk about what Israel is demanding for a ceasefire. Axios reports Israel demands its air force has freedom of operation in Lebanese airspace, also demands, Israel demands, that the IDF be allowed to engage in active enforcement to attack Hezbollah. This would be part of the ceasefire that they say they would accept.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, in fact, this is a maximalist position by the Israelis. They don't want, clearly, they don't want a ceasefire. Clearly, they don't want to respect the UN Resolution 1701. I remind everyone that UN Resolution 1701 is very clear. As per this resolution, the Lebanese army should be deployed in the south, but it's also should we equip in order for it to be able to defend Lebanon from potential aggressions. The Lebanese government also demands the demarcation of the borders with Israel. Till now, Israel does not recognize any borders with Lebanon except that for the blue line, which is a withdrawal line and not the borders. This shows that Israel is not serious about a potential ceasefire, but not only that. This poses question as to what the United States of America want. Are they impartial when it comes to these negotiations? I remind everyone that Amos Hodgkin was serving at the Israeli army. So is he impartial? Is he not? This is a question. This is a serious question. But so far, as we saw in Gaza on many occasions, the Americans are complicit in this genocide, and they're complicit in the war against Lebanon. And there is nothing that shows that they really want to impose a ceasefire on Lebanon. Not only that, they probably would like to, and this is what Amos Hodgkin said, to protect the interest of the Israelis by him referring to the fact that the Lebanese government or the UNIFIL did not even enforce 1701 in the past, and he did not refer at all to the many violations of the Israelis when it comes to the 1701, specifically when it comes to the airspace violation of Lebanon during these 20 years.
Jamil Mouad is assistant professor of politics and policy at Department of Political Studies and Public Administration at the American University of Beirut, speaking to us from Beirut. The Biden administration has launched a probe after highly classified U.S. intelligence documents were posted online showing Israel's taking steps to launch a retaliatory attack on Iran. One document came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the other from the NSA, the National Security Agency. The documents reference recent Israeli drills involving air-launched ballistic missiles as well as covert drone activity. On Friday, President Biden was asked if he knew how and when Israel would attack Iran. Biden responded by saying yes and yes, unquote. Iran has issued a complaint with the UN's nuclear watchdog over Israeli threats to strike Iran's atomic energy sites in retaliation for a series of Iranian missiles that were fired into Israel earlier this month. Iran's foreign ministry issued a statement today saying, quote, threats to attack nuclear sites are against UN resolutions and are condemned, unquote. This comes as a drone hit Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's seaside home Saturday in the northern Israeli town of Caesarea. Netanyahu and his family were not home at the time of the incident, which caused superficial damage to his home. He shared this video on social media after the attack.
Prime Minister, how is it going?
Well, 2 days ago, we took out Yahya Sinwar, the terrorist mastermind, whose goons beheaded our men, raped our women, burnt babies alive. We took him out, and we're continuing our battle with Iran's other terrorist proxies. We're going to win this war.
So will something deter you?
No.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to his aide. The prime minister also wrote on social media, quote, the attempt by Iran's proxy Hezbollah to assassinate me and my wife today was a grave mistake. I say to Iran and its proxies and its axis of evil, anyone who tries to harm Israel's citizens will pay a heavy price, Netanyahu said. From where we go to Tehran, to Iran, where we're joined by Hassan Ahmadiyen, assistant professor of West Asian and North African Studies at the University of Tehran. Professor, we welcome you to Democracy Now! If you can start off by responding to what Netanyahu said, blaming agents of Iran for the attack, though Iran disavowed responsibility for the attack on his seaside home. We may have lost Professor Ahmadiyen. I think he's coming back right now. Why don't we break, and we'll see if we can get back in touch with Professor Ahmadiyen, who is in Tehran, Iran. I think we have him. Professor Ahmadiyen, thank you for joining us. Can you respond to what Netanyahu said, that agents of Iran were responsible for the attack on his seaside home? If you can respond.
Yes. Well, I think maybe Netanyahu has been trying to portray everything that's happening in Gaza and Lebanon around the region as part of Iran's act, whereas we all know it's a fact now that Iran didn't know about the 7th of October attack. And then its allies fighting Israel for their various national reasons, they are supported by Iran, but it doesn't mean that they act on behalf of Iran. But obviously, Bibi's eyeing another game. He wants to see a confrontation bigger than his surrounding. He wants the U.S., Iran to be dragged into a conflict, I think. That's why he's pointing always to Iran. In the beginning of his campaign on Gaza, he was focused on Gaza. And then when he wanted to widen the war, he started to point at Iran, and he started hitting Iranian targets. First came the Iranian consulate, then Iran retaliated. Then came the assassination in Tehran of Ismail Haniyeh in the inauguration day of a new president in Iran. Then Iran waited for a diplomatic settlement that Amos Hochstein and the Americans channeled to Iran that they are after, and they're using this assassination for a ceasefire there. The Iranians waited for 2 months only to be surprised by Netanyahu moving to Lebanon, assassinating and the pager attack, the walkie-talkie attack, then the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. All of this came after Iran waited for a diplomatic settlement in Gaza. And then Iran decided that that's enough. We need to retaliate. Otherwise, our deterrence will be at stake. Obviously, to my understanding, but Netanyahu is inching closer to, you know, a confrontation with Iran. The Iranians have said time and time again that they will retaliate. They have been retaliating. Now he's talking about retaliating against Iran's retaliation, which is basically escalation ladder. He's on and he's trying to tell the world that it's Iran that is the provocateur. Whereas in Iran, everyone feels the way that Bibi Netanyahu is trying to frame Iran internationally. And as such, they are focusing on telling the world that we will not go for a war, we will not go for a confrontation, but if it's enforced upon us, we will have to retaliate. Otherwise, our deterrence will not work, and then it will be an open season in Tehran, maybe.
So, Professor, can you comment on these leaked U.S. documents, intelligence documents, describing satellite images of Israeli military preparations for a potential strike in Iran? You also have the foreign ministry coming out today in Tehran, speaking out and saying it would be illegal to attack nuclear plants in Iran, according to the United Nations. If you can comment on all of this, the intelligence documents, not clear how they were leaked, coming from, among other places, the NSA, the National Security Agency, the intelligence agency in the United States that's many times larger than the CIA.
Now, we still don't know what the intricacies of this leaks. But obviously, if they are intentional or not intentional, the leaking, it makes a difference. I mean, the messaging or the message of them being linked will be different. But in any case, I think the Iranians are saying that these leaks show that the Israelis are trying to attack, places of strategic importance that are legally, should not be attacked. But Israel is obviously trying or inching closer to attack them. It's within the Iranian, international or diplomatic reach, which the foreign minister and the president have been on the past few weeks, telling the world that we don't want escalation. But obviously, the Israelis are coming to force it upon us, and we will have to retaliate. The legality of the issue is obvious. I mean, it's illegal as per international law to attack. I mean, the Atomic Energy Agency structure. It's very obvious that it's not legal to attack such places. But I mean, the Israeli policy in assassinating scientists, killing a guest in an inauguration day in Iran, All the policies that have been pulled off previously were illegal as well. So the Iranians know that this is not going to affect the situation, but they are telling the world, these are the evidence. We're not after this escalation, but you should look at Israel and what it's doing to provoke Iran and its allies to retaliate.
Professor Ahmadian, can you talk very briefly about Iran-Saudi relations and how that plays into this? Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was in Riyadh earlier this month. And the fact that the 180 ballistic missiles that were shot into Israel killed one person, a Palestinian in Jericho, but these were 180 ballistic missiles. Is Iran actually coordinating this, sharing information with the United States?
I'm not sure that is the case, especially the second attack that Iran, rather retaliation that Iran did in October 1st. The first one was coordinated. Iran told the world and the United States and indirectly Israel as well that we are not, we will attack in this timing. It was basically a political messaging that we can beat you, we can hit you, but we don't want escalation, so don't push us. The second attack for October 1st was a military nature. The Iranians showed their muscles, telling the Israelis, you're playing with fire, we can do this. Today, the message was that we can fire 7,000 missiles a day to deter Israel. But basically, the narrative is that we don't want escalation, but we are capable of fighting. When it comes to Saudi Arabia and the GCC in general, the Iranians are trying hard to keep them away from, basically assisting Israel, and also keep the warming up of the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia ongoing. The Iranians and the Saudis both have been pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza. The Saudis embarked on a diplomatic, campaign with the Europeans, with the Americans, for months now to stop the conflict in Gaza. The Iranians trying to push, saying that we don't want, that the Israelis are widening the war and that this will be catastrophe it was a political messaging campaign and also pushing back against Israeli provocation as the Iranians see them. Both have been basically met in the aim of stopping the Gaza war. And I think the relationship has been enhancing unexpectedly. Basically, the war in Gaza have brought Iran and Saudi Arabia, at least publicly and in the narrative, much closer than where we were before the October 7th. And both, as I said, they are aiming for the same target, that is the stop of the onslaught on Gaza and elsewhere in the region.
Hassan Ahmadian, I want to thank you for being with us, Assistant Professor of West Asian and North African Studies at the University of Tehran, speaking to us from Tehran, Iran, previously associate with the Project on Shiism and Global Affairs at Harvard's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs. Coming up, Elon Musk pledges to give away $1 million a day to voters who sign his super PAC petition. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton. He's got a new piece out on U.S. agencies funding and fighting with Elon Musk. A Trump presidency could give him power over them. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. With the presidential election just 2 weeks away, we look at the richest man in the world, one of Donald Trump's biggest financial backers, tech billionaire Elon Musk. He's poured an additional $75 million into his pro-Trump super PAC. And at a campaign town hall in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Saturday, Musk pledged to give away $1 million to voters who signed his super PAC online petition in battleground states. he pledged to give this every day, $1 million away until Election Day.
I have a surprise for you, which is that we are going to be awarding $1 million to randomly to people who have signed the petition every day from now until the election.
To be eligible for the $1 million, petition signers must be registered to vote and live in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin. Many say this is illegal. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro was asked if Musk's sweepstakes was legal during an interview with Meet the Press Sunday.
I think there are real questions with how he is spending money in this race, how the dark money is flowing, not just into Pennsylvania, but apparently now into the pockets of Pennsylvanians. That is deeply concerning. I think it's something that law enforcement could take a look at. I'm not the attorney general anymore of Pennsylvania. I'm the governor. But it does raise some serious questions.
Meanwhile, a new investigation by The New York Times looks at Musk's influence over the federal government, with two of his companies, SpaceX and Tesla, accounting for at least $15.4 billion in government contracts over the past decade. For more, we'll go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Eric Lipton, who co-authored the Times investigation headlined U.S. Agencies Fund and Fight with Elon Musk. A Trump presidency could give him power over them. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you start off by responding to this promise that Elon Musk has made, $1 million a day to voters in battleground states who sign his super PAC petition, Eric?
I don't really know the legality of that proposal. I suspect, I have to imagine that there were lawyers that examined that before he made that proposal and that promise. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that's a trivial amount of money for Elon Musk. He's the richest person in the world. He's presumably the richest person in the history of the world. So that's a pretty small amount of to invest in this, in the final days of this election campaign. And he has, you know, literally billions of dollars at stake of his own business operations, both is in terms of contracts that he has with the federal government. And, you know, millions of dollars at stake in terms of the many investigations that are ongoing of his company. So that's kind of like pocket change, relatively speaking.
Well, of course, the significance is it may be trivial for him, but for people who would receive it, that's the question. Is it a payoff?
Right.
But Eric.
Right. And I can't address the legality of that. That's up to lawyers and regulators to address.
So talk about this piece that you've just done. You're a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. This investigative report is quite remarkable. Lay out his empire and but most importantly also the contracts he gets from the U.S. government and what a Trump presidency is, of course, supporting Trump big time, would mean for him.
I don't think that it's reasonable to presume that he would get, you know, necessarily more contracting dollars if Trump were president. He is already incredibly popular because of SpaceX, almost exclusively, really, the bulk of it. And it's because his business has been so successful at transforming access to orbit and also communications from orbit. And so both with NASA and the Department of Defense, they're spending billions of dollars to buy services from him because he's delivering things that other companies aren't delivering. So on that side of the ledger, I think he's going to continue to see an increase in business with the federal government because of the services that SpaceX is providing. But the real question is on the investigative side, because Elon Musk is so determined to get things done, and ultimately his real goal is to get humans to Mars, that he often likes to kind of, you know, cut corners when it comes to regulations. He wants to bulldoze his way through. And so he has an incredible array of disagreements with federal agencies that oversee his operations, both from Tesla and from SpaceX. And so it's really all you could go through the acronym soup of the United States government, and just about every major agency has some pending investigation, in many cases involving repeat offenses and, you know, multiple fines and or ongoing investigations. And so it's the thing that is most potentially problematic is if he is, in fact, going to be appointed by Trump to be the head of some efficiency committee that's going to examine federal regulators and the powers that they have and also examine their budgets. How is it possible that he could be simultaneously the subject of multiple investigations, the recipient of billions of dollars in contract, and the guy that's going to be deciding how to curb regulatory powers and how to reduce the expenditures for these agencies? It's just way too many roles that creates obvious potential or real conflicts of interest.
Let me ask you, last year alone, Elon Musk's company secured $3 billion in contracts from 17 federal agencies. Do you think we're talking about, to say the least, an over-dependence on Musk's companies, which are private companies? And talk more about, you know, Tesla, about SpaceX, and how it's intertwined with the government.
Yeah, the bulk of that money really is going to SpaceX. There's a relatively small amount that goes to Tesla. And most of that money, the biggest chunk of it, goes for launch. And the Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, the two reliable rockets that Elon Musk and SpaceX have, are just the workhorses both for NASA and for the Department of Defense and for the intelligence community. And you know, it's a combination of factors that he has been so successful in designing, you know, an engineering design on his rockets and the reusability of the parts of it that no one else can really match him. And, you know, Lockheed and Boeing, and they have a consortium that's called United Launch Alliance that's really struggled to get a new rocket going. It still is not ready for national security launches. So the Department of Defense in particular is really reliant upon SpaceX. And I've written about this separately in another story earlier this year, just how completely dependent the United States currently is on him. And I mean, it's not as if they're giving him contracts because of who he is. They're giving him contracts because he can reliably get the NASA satellites and Defense Department and intelligence satellites in the space.
So if you could talk about, for example, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration opening five investigations into Tesla's safety issues, and also Tesla's ongoing legal battles with the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, including cases where the company tried to block rulings punishing Musk for anti-union tweets.
Right. I mean, there's so many of these investigations. I have a little cheat sheet that I kind of built as I was kind of scouring the reach of the federal government to look at all the dockets and pull together information about each of these. But yes, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has five different ongoing active investigations relating to things like unintended acceleration, steering wheel detachment, steering loss, and of course, most popularly, the self-driving and the fatal accident involving self-driving. And so that's just at one division of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Over next door at the FAA, they recently fined SpaceX about $600,000 based on their conclusion that SpaceX had improperly conducted two launches last year out of Florida that they were not compliant with safety requirements. So that's two divisions of DOT. There's also the transportation also was investigating. This is the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, another division of transportation. So now it's three different agencies in the one cabinet department. Find Neuralink, which is building implants into brains to help people, who are either disabled to see again or maybe to walk again. But Neuralink was shipping hazardous materials without a hazardous materials permit. So that was another investigation and fine. So, I mean, that's just one federal agency, but it goes on and on. There's over a dozen.
Eric,
the Department of Justice.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. Eric Lipton, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, investigative reporter at The New York Times, will link to your piece, U.S. Agencies Fund and Fight with Elon Musk, A Trump Presidency Could Give Him Power Over Them. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Robbie Caron, and wishing you all health. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
From natural disasters to unforeseen accidents, emergency preparedness is a crucial element of maintaining a safe school environment. Canada's diverse geography means schools can be vulnerable to a range of natural hazards, including severe weather, flooding, wildfires, and earthquakes. National School Safety Week is October 17 to 23, and the Canada Safety Council urges schools and communities to focus on strengthening emergency preparedness protocols. Find out more at CanadaSafetyCouncil.org.